Good morning. I think we'll bring this to order. And good morning. Are you okay? I think we're all in for a treat. We truly have what I consider to be an all-star panel to discuss a topic that I think is what I would call a quintessential Federalist Society topic, and that is second look doctrines. For example, should Congress be empowered to override Supreme Court decisions? That's only one aspect of it. Our panel truly needs no introduction. Their full biographies are in our program materials, but just let me mention briefly who we have here. We have Professor Richard Epstein, formerly of the University of Chicago Law School.
Still,
I heard a rumor that you had left. So. It's complicated. Okay. Still with the University of Chicago Law School. Now, in addition to all of his scholarship over the years, Professor Epstein has written numerous articles and op-eds on a wide variety of legal and interdisciplinary subjects. We also have Judge Frank Easterbrook of the Seventh Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals. And in addition to his very, very heavy judicial responsibilities, Judge Easterbrook has published over 100 scholarly articles. And finally, we have Professor Neil Katyal of Georgetown University. And in addition to all of his heavy academic workloads, he found time to successfully argue the Hamdan case in the Supreme Court, and also served as co-chair of former Vice President Al Gore's election dispute before the Supreme Court. Now, each panelist will have 10 to 15 minutes to make their presentations, followed by a round of two-minute rebuttals, which will then be followed by your questions and hopefully some answers. We'll probably have answers. Now, before I turn it over to the panel, I found a great, great quote, which I think is relevant to this morning's topic, and it comes from former President Gerald Ford, and the quote is from the time when he was a member of the House of Representatives. And this sort of sets the stage, I think, this quote from former President Ford, it sets the stage for this morning's discussion. Representative Ford said, "I refuse to concede that the elected representatives of the American people cannot be the winner in a confrontation with the United States Supreme Court. To admit that the American people cannot control the U.S. Supreme Court, I think the American people today must have some control and jurisdiction over the judiciary of the federal government. The people of America, not the courts, are the ultimate authority in our great country." So, this morning, I hope we will learn something about that quote in the context of what some of us sometimes call the tyranny of the majority, and how does that concept fit with the quote from the former president. And I'll turn the program now over to Judge Easterbrook.
Thank you. Thank you. This panel is designed to explore the question whether Congress or the people through referenda and initiatives should be authorized to supersede judicial views about constitutional meaning. The unstated premise is that judicial decisions need revising. Now, everybody agrees with that premise, although they don't agree about which judicial decisions need revising. People in this room are apt to point to opinions such as Kennedy against Louisiana, which held that the Constitution forbids the death penalty for child rape. The majority rested on a supposed national consensus disapproving the use of that punishment. The decision was dubious because in a federal republic, minority views among states are supposed to be respected rather than extinguished. When the justices were then embarrassed by the fact that Congress itself had overwhelmingly and recently approved capital punishment for child rape by members of the military, and thus that the national consensus favored this punishment, they issued a new opinion which said, effectively, "Never mind what we said a few months ago. In fact, we don't care what the people think. This penalty is unconstitutional because we disapprove it." But while some people object to Kennedy because it went too far in displacing democratic choice on the basis of an ambiguous constitutional norm, Others object to decisions such as Employment Division against Smith, the Peyote decision, on the ground that they're too deferential to legislatures. Smith held that laws neutral with respect to religion don't violate the First Amendment's Free Exercise Clause, even if they interfere with a religion's tenets or sacraments. Congress responded with the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which the court promptly held unconstitutional on the ground that only judges can determine the meaning of the 14th Amendment. Can we do better by allowing Congress or the people themselves to displace decisions such as Kennedy and Smith? That's what Robert Bork argued in Slouching Toward Gomorrah. I'm one of Bob Bork's old friends and greatly respect his views, but I think that he called that one wrong. Judicial excess is a serious problem, but legislative excess is a problem too, and potentially a greater problem. Let me start with initiatives and referenda. These allow the people to express their will directly. But is government by the people beneficial? James Madison, the man whose silhouette is everywhere at this meeting, designed the Constitution to avoid direct democracy because he and the other framers thought that it had been a bane wherever it was used, and not just because direct democracy in Athens had put Socrates to death. Madison explained in Federalist No. 10, which I think is the greatest political essay ever written, that direct democracy is prone to faction. Everybody prefers self-interest to the general interest. Representative democracy has its own problems, but the process of persuading legislators brings factions into the open and allows them to be combated. When direct democracy is not driven by faction, it's afflicted by ignorance. During the last election season, all of you must have cringed at one or another answer, depressingly shallow, that a politician gave to a complex question. It's not that politicians dumb things down for sound bites on TV, although surely there's some of that. It's that any issue worth a political debate is complex, and society faces a lot of complex issues. Intuitions about complex questions tend to be wrong because people don't consider all the ways in which the targets of regulation respond to legal rules. Often, perhaps usually, beliefs about what will happen turn out to be wrong, even backward. That intuitions don't work is one thing on which almost all social scientists agree. Our brains are wired by evolution to solve our own problems, not to handle complex social interactions. So the law of unintended consequences is universal. Well, if difficult questions baffle even people who work full-time on public policy, what chance is there that society could do better by committing decisions to those who spend very little time on those problems? Even if the general populace were trained in forming and testing hypotheses, why would they spend much time on the subject? Any given person's chance of influencing the outcome of a referendum is significantly less than his chance of being run down by a bus on the way to the polls. So people don't study these issues. They're rationally ignorant. They vote their intuitions. Well, that may be fine for a single high-visibility issue with a binary choice, such as deciding whether to allow gay marriage as opposed to civil unions in California. It's terrible for deciding a complex question, such as how to handle liquidity in an interlocked economy, or how to accommodate the practices of minority religions. Suppose that instead of committing the second look to the populace, we commit it to the legislature. Will we do better? Well, to a degree, we're bound to, for the very reasons that Madison gave. Representatives have more time and can engage in more deliberation. Lobbyists and interest groups and the press, and even, though rarely, scholars, can bring information to the legislature's attention and improve the quality of decision. But for any given issue, since Congress is busy, the justices are apt to have more time and more information. Now, in saying that, I'm not trying to sweep under the rug the fact that the justices have exercised more power than the Constitution allots them. Recall the rationale of Marbury. It's the Constitution is superior to a statute and has to be enforced to the extent that it is law. But when there's only a debate about wise policy, Chief Justice Marshall reminded us in McCulloch, choice belongs to the legislature. Yet in many cases, of which Kennedy against Louisiana is a good example, the justices have claimed the authority to make a final decision even when there is no legal rule to be found in the Constitution, and the right choice depends on moral values or contestable empirical propositions. McCulloch tells us that those are legislative rather than judicial choices. Yet the problem is endemic to finality. Our Constitution rests on a system of checks and balances. Any unreviewed power tends to be abused. To repeat a familiar phrase, all power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. The justices have proved that proposition for the power of constitutional review. Now suppose we transfer that power from the court to Congress. Will it end abuse? How could it? If Congress were final, then it would abuse its powers. We should expect claims of legislative power to be even more sweeping than those that the court has tolerated. If finality in court leads to aggrandizement of the judicial branch, finality in Congress will lead to aggrandizement of the legislative branch. And, as Hamilton argued in Federalist No. 78, if we're to choose between evils, it's best to choose the judges, for Congress has other formidable powers, such as those of tax, spending, and regulation. Too much power in one place is a fatal blunder. So if we're to choose who is to abuse the power, we should choose in favor of abuse by the person with the fewest additional powers. Now, perhaps this way of putting things implies a decision rule. When the justices say that the Constitution contains a real rule of law, then their word would be final. But when the justices say that they're just detecting a national consensus or engaged in balancing competing interests, then the political branches could make their own choice. The justices' approach would be just provisional, a form of constitutional common law, as Henry Monahan once put it. The thought is attractive, but could it be made operational? Consider two episodes from our constitutional history. After the Supreme Court held that literacy tests are compatible with the 14th and 15th Amendments, Congress used its legislative powers in the Voting Rights Act to forbid them. The court held the statute valid because Section 5 of the 14th Amendment and Section 2 of the 15th Amendment commit policy decisions to the legislature. The court said that its earlier decision was just provisional. But when Congress responded to Smith with the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, the justices took offense and asserted that only judges could determine the scope of constitutional provisions. Well, when we commit to the court the question whether decisions are provisional and hence amenable to legislative change, the justices are apt to say that our decisions weren't provisional. Look at Marbury. Our decisions are effective only when they're real law. But if we commit the same question to Congress, the legislature is bound to assert just as strongly that the decision it is displacing was just constitutional common law. So the legislature is entitled to the final say. How are disputes of that kind to be resolved? The question will depend on the identity of the decision maker. The second episode that I have in mind is the legislative response to Miranda against Arizona, which held that four specific warnings are implied components of the Constitution's self-incrimination clause. Here, the justices even conceded that they were making constitutional common law. Miranda invited the legislature to come up with something better. Congress responded by enacting a statute that says, in effect, warnings aren't essential. Judges have to decide case by case, in light of all the circumstances, whether a confession has been coerced. That was the approach that had preceded Miranda. And the court had abandoned it in Miranda because it's hard for judges to apply that approach at retail. It requires hearings, thought, decisions. The justices preferred an easy rule to a hard standard. Congress responded that the standard is the way to go. Now, one might think that a choice between a rule and a standard for implementing a constitutional norm is quintessentially legislative. If using a standard made the constitutional rule infeasible, then a rule it must be. The justices said that once in Gideon about the old Betts rule for deciding when defendants were entitled to legal counsel. But more recently, the court has used a standard to evaluate claims of ineffective assistance of counsel, and it still uses the coerced confession standard as a backup to Miranda. So the justices should have allowed the legislative choice to prevail. If a standard makes judges work harder, so be it. The Constitution does not promise judges rocking chair jobs. Nonetheless, the justices said, roughly, Miranda must be constitutional since we applied it against the state of Arizona, and therefore it must be immune to legislative change. That's the Dickerson decision. It was written by William Rehnquist, and only Justices Scalia and Thomas dissented. Chief Justice Rehnquist wrote an opinion, which I think completely misunderstood the issue. He asked, is coerced confession a constitutional subject? He answered yes and thought that was the end. But the real question is the choice of detail itself a constitutional subject? The court should have allowed Congress to make the latter choice for criminal procedure as it did for voting rights. But I despair of any workable rule that will achieve that end. As long as the justices have the final say, they will muscle into legislative territory. And if the legislators have the final say, they will muscle in on territory reserved by the Constitution for supermajority decision. Much as I dislike it when 5-4 decisions of the Supreme Court effectively amend the Constitution, when the Constitution itself requires votes of 2/3 of each House plus 3/4 of the states, so I dislike the prospect of Congress amending the Constitution by simple majority and of reamending it a few years later when the balance of political power has swung from one party to the other. Judicial decisions, for all their flaws, are more stable than legislative decisions and more likely, on balance, to implement constitutional values. Now, I said that I despair of a workable rule that will keep each branch within its proper sphere, but one shouldn't give up without looking at how other nations have handled this question. Foreign law is a good resource. Not a good resource to construe the U.S. Constitution, a subject that I discussed here last year, but to show whether there are workable alternatives to the U.S. Constitution. Several other nations allow legislatures to override constitutional decisions, but none of those nations creates the sort of distinction that I have proposed between strictly legal decisions and those that balance interests or reach prudential outcomes. Nor does any of them depend on a voting rule. That is to say, one might allocate to the legislature a final decision when the court divides 5-4 or 6-3 on the ground that that suggests there's no clear legal rule, while saying that a decision of 7-2 or better means that there's real law inappropriate for legislative control. But neither that approach nor the law versus pragmatism approach has ever been adopted anywhere else. And it seems to me the lack of adoption implies that it is probably infeasible. Time is short, so I'll discuss only one other nation's approach, the notwithstanding clause in Canada's constitution. Canada permits both national and provincial legislators to implement their laws from judicial review under the Charter of Rights and Liberties, which was adopted in 1982. The shelter may be given when a law is first adopted or in response to a judicial decision. The power isn't limited by subject matter. It's not limited by whether the decision is divided. It's not limited by whether the Supreme Court of Canada's decision is legal or prudential. Instead, Canada creates a temporal limit. The notwithstanding clause will insulate a law for only 5 years. In other words, it operates like a sunset law. The notwithstanding clause can be renewed, but unless there's a reasonably contemporary majority of the legislature in favor of a law, the decision of the Supreme Court of Canada will prevail. Well, how has this power been used? The Supreme Court of Canada has been to the left of this nation's Supreme Court for at least 20 years, but then so has Canada's Parliament largely been to our left. And it's not a huge surprise that Parliament has never used the notwithstanding clause. Now, that might change as center-right coalition took power in Canada in 2006, but there's no majority. It's operating as a coalition, which greatly complicates use of the notwithstanding clause. Provinces, though, have often found that their views differ substantially from those of Canada's Supreme Court. Quebec has invoked the notwithstanding clause 14 times. One of those was to protect the province's French-only language rules, even though the charter expressly had nullified any rule undermining the nation's bilingualism and the language rights of natives. To accommodate the Inuit, who were, to say the least, very put out by a French-only rule, Nunavut was constructed out of national land, the eastern part of the Northwest Territories, to serve in part as a refuge for the Inuit-speaking natives of Quebec. Can you imagine a legislative override in the United States that led to a state being split in two, or to the creation of a territory to act as a place for refugees from that state to go? And Quebec has not limited its use of the notwithstanding clause to language. It's essentially opted out of the compact. It has used the clause 13 times, 13 additional times, and one of those was a general, none of our laws is subject to the Charter of Rights and Freedoms clause. It's as if the old states of the Confederacy had tried to opt out of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. Now, Saskatchewan, Alberta, and Yukon have used the clause once apiece for relatively small reasons. So to sum up, Quebec has used the power in ways that would be utterly beyond the pale in the United States. Other legislatures in Canada have either not used the power at all or have used it in such modest ways that it has not been an effective check on judicial power. Neither of those disparate uses of the notwithstanding clause suggests that it would be a good model for the United States. So I must close where I began. The Supreme Court's exaggerated view of its judicial powers has little support in our Constitution, and it's understandable why people search for a solution that gives greater scope to federalism and to democratic choice. But the alternatives to the current situation could well be worse than the disease. This is not a happy answer, I know, though perhaps it should sit well in this body, because it means that the battle of ideas in which this organization is engaged remains the right forum in which this contest should be waged. Thank you very much.
I want to thank Dean Reuter and Larry Thompson for inviting me to be here. It's a real joy to be here today with all of you. I'm such a believer in the tradition of open-minded debate that your organization sponsors, and I frankly wish all organizations were as welcoming as this one. That is our great constitutional tradition reflected in the First Amendment in Article 1, Section 6 to our Constitution, and I'm really honored to be here today. Now, I know not all of you may feel this way about me. I know it's not because I represented Bin Laden's driver. I know the savvy ones among you know that, as the Georgetown student I just met out in the hall said, you know, you're not the most exciting of speakers. I saw some of my course evaluations this year, and this is what they said. Help, I've fallen asleep and cannot wake up. Course was very thorough. What wasn't covered in class was covered on the final exam. He is one of the best teachers I've ever had. He is well organized, presents good lectures, and creates interest in the subject. I hope my comments don't hurt his chances of getting tenure. My favorite, teacher improved steadily throughout the course. I think he started drinking and it really loosened him up. Okay, those are all made up, but here's a true story, and let me start where Judge Easterbrook's remarkable talk started. As many of you know, I argued this case, Hamdan versus Rumsfeld, about the Guantanamo military tribunals, and I'm used to getting a certain number of accolades, particularly when I go to New York. Now, last month, I went to New York and had the double whammy. I had New York City and the NPR crowd. It was the New York Public Library where I was giving a talk, so I expected a certain reception, and instead I got hissed at by a large audience. Now, why did I get hissed at? Not because New Yorkers are opposed to my work on Guantanamo, but the crowd was very opposed to my work in Kennedy versus Louisiana. And just so we're all on the same page, this is a decision announced in June, 5-4 decision, as Judge Easterbrook telegraphed, that said that Louisiana could not punish with the death penalty the horrible crime of child rape. When the decision came out, 3 days later, a military blogger pointed out that the federal government had the death penalty for the crime of child rape. It had been authorized by Congress just 2 years before the Supreme Court decision in a statute. I wound up representing the state of Louisiana on the petition for rehearing in that case, not because I'm some fervent believer in the death penalty. I'm actually opposed to the death penalty personally. But I think, as I think Judge Easterbrook is getting at, these are decisions that should be handled by our legislative body, not by our courts. And so while I think it's an old-fashioned idea, I think that the justices should not be striking down state legislative decisions absent a clear legal reason for doing so, and that clear legal reason has to come from the text, history, and structure of our foundational document, the Constitution of the United States. And that, I think, is what Larry Thompson's quote from Jerry Ford as representative is getting at, that the people are the ultimate repository in our country and not the policy preferences of five people who sit on one First Street. Now, I know many of you in this organization share that vision, and I applaud you for it. I dare say that some of the nominees that many folks in this room have supported to the courts haven't always shared that vision. And you can look at this any number of ways. You can look at it historically, that for the first 200 years of our Constitution's existence, the court struck down 127 federal laws. But from 1994 to 2000, just in 6 years, they struck down 24, roughly six a term. Many of these cases have occurred in areas of major social policy. We've talked about the child rape case, but there's the Violence Against Women Act case. There's the Religious Freedom Restoration case that Judge Easterbrook mentioned a moment ago. There's a number of recent cases, gun control, Seattle and Louisville schools, campaign finance reform, presidential election dispute of 2000. I know many of these individual decisions may be justified, and to many of you, and maybe all of them are justified, but I think that taken together, they do demonstrate that the court is intervening into the social sphere in a much larger arena of cases than they have previously. And what I worry about the most, given is the fact that it's very hard to ever walk back these decisions, given the twin things of Article III, life tenure, and the history of judicial impeachments, particularly after Chase. So it's very difficult to impeach a justice for their good faith reasoning, and properly so, in a decision. The result, though, think about Kennedy versus Louisiana. The hardest part about that, I think, is that now, for all time, it's almost impossible to change that decision. Why? Because even if you change the composition of the court, 5-4, and suppose that one of those members of the majority comes off the court, how are we ever going to bring another case that will second-guess Kennedy versus Louisiana? Because any state legislator who now introduces a bill for to use the death penalty for the crime of child rape is going to be laughed at as an unconstitutional oath. The colleagues in the legislature are going to say, what are you talking about? The Supreme Court just declared this unconstitutional. How can we pass such a law? It'll be very difficult to create that test case. And so you have essentially a dynamic of a one-way ratchet in which the cruel and unusual punishment clause is being used to kind of freeze into place a certain substantive conception of what the law should be, not just now, but perhaps for all time. And that, I think, is a particularly dangerous feature of this court's kind of rapid intervention into areas of social policy. Now, I think that we need to fight this basic vision that I think now there's almost a political accommodation on both the left and the right for a kind of this greater amount of court activism. I think we do need to fight it, and we should fight it with everything we've got. But suppose we lose. Suppose we're not able to do that. What I want to ask in this talk is there some sort of second best solution to the problem when courts are engaging in areas of social policy? Now, one second best solution is the simple notion that the Congress, by a bare legislative majority, can trump what the United States Supreme Court says. And I want to reject that for reasons that I think Judge Easterbrook so eloquently stated a moment ago. So is there something else that we can do? And here's one possible idea. The idea is for courts to think about adopting sunsets on their judicial decisions. Legislatures already do this when they're engaged in social policy. So when, after Watergate, the Congress has a desire to try and regulate executive branch wrongdoing, they create the Ethics in Government Act of 1978, which has in it the Independent Council. Some people feared a kind of unaccountable, headless monster that would be created. Others said it would be a good idea. And what the legislature did was say, well, we don't really know how this is going to work in practice, so let's try this out for 5 years, and then the act will sunset and has to be affirmatively renewed. And, of course, we know the experience. Unfortunately, the act was not ultimately affirmatively renewed in 1999. Another one, the Patriot Act. The nation is horribly attacked on 9/11. There's a proposal for massive changes to our law enforcement apparatus. Civil libertarians and others are worried, well, this is maybe too great a change. Maybe we're overreacting. And so the compromise is struck to say, well, let's sunset some of the features of the act after 4 years, and let's see how it works in practice, and then it'll be affirmatively renewed. So this is basically a kind of time-honored tradition that we use when we're setting massive changes in social policy. Now, today, our federal courts, for better or worse, are engaged in some of those same social policy decisions as the legislature is. And judicial resolution of these questions that they're engaged in is fraught with the same types of problems as legislative resolution. If you think about the Patriot Act and some of the things that were said, that there's a tendency to overreact in a crisis. There's an all-too-human desire to prefer security to liberty and equality and so on. All of those observations apply to jurists as well. And two other things apply to jurists that don't apply to legislatures. One is that judges are largely unaccountable in that they can't be removed for their unpopular decisions. And second, their decisions are entitled to stare decisis. And given these two characteristics of judges, it's kind of surprising nobody's advocated judicial sunsets. And that lack of attention is even more surprising when one thinks about what Justice O'Connor said in a case that many of you know, Grutter versus Bollinger, the affirmative action case out of the University of Michigan Law School. Because she said, we expect 25 years from now the use of racial preferences will no longer be necessary to further the interest approved today. Now, one way of thinking about what Justice O'Connor said is to view it as a judicial sunset. She was worried about a holding that would prevent affirmative action from being contested in perpetuity. Now, regardless of whether my reading of Grutter is descriptively correct, I think it suggests a template for how this could be used. The court, when it's setting out on an area of social policy, could say, we're worried about it. We're worried about it in Kennedy versus Louisiana. So we think that we're not sure whether we believe that there is whether this national consensus against the use of the death penalty for the crime of child rape will hold. Therefore, we believe after 5 years, or after they could designate some event, depending on the particular case, that our decision is not entitled to the full weight of stare decisis. And they announce it ex ante. And then afterwards, after that time period, the decision becomes persuasive authority, not binding. It becomes kind of like an out-of-circuit precedent or something like that, something that could be cited but isn't necessarily going to bind the court to its previous holding. Now, there are two basic advantages of this. One is error correction. Just as with the legislature, which may err when announcing major changes, so too it is with the courts. Indeed, there are many arguments for why courts will be worse when they engage in policy decisions than the legislature. And therefore, it's better to have a court decision that kind of self-consciously says in it, we might not be right for all time, and we want to make sure that there's an opportunity for correction. Instead, however, right now, instead of having a device that minimizes the effect of error, we have a device in the form of stare decisis that magnifies it over time. And so you have contested, you have all the way into the future, a very difficult problem of how to kind of walk back a decision that is wrong. And of course, because of the superiority of the Supreme Court over lower courts, that the impact of a judicial error is magnified across the entire nation. So you have it both in terms of distance, a magnification of the error over distance, and over time. And then the second feature is agenda setting. The second reason why the courts might want to do this is agenda setting. That is, if the court announces in advance that its decision is only going to be good for a certain number of years as binding authority, then it puts everyone on notice, litigants, governments, and interested parties alike, that after a certain number of years, there should be legislative agitation. There should be legislative agitation, for example, in 5 years, the argument would go, for the death penalty for the use of child rape, or something like that. So everyone is on notice, and the idea then is to create those test cases to second-guess decisions that otherwise might be entrenched into law. And routinely we're given, in areas of social policy now, kind of, I think, very unilluminating answers. I mean, I was struck in the Guantanamo stuff that, you know, we were given as the answers by both sides that, you know, on questions of security versus liberty, people are talking about what the Supreme Court said in 1942 or 1950. And that strikes me as not a good place to be. Obviously, I think we start with the text and history and structure of the Constitution. And then, after that, if the answer isn't clear, then I think we need to be reflective about the fact that if the justices are going to engage in areas of social policy and make decisions, that they do so with some sort of device that will minimize the amount of errors, minimize the impact of the errors over time and over distance. To me, that might counsel in favor of a judicial sunset, but as I said at the outset, I think the most important thing we all have to do is try and get the initial decision right, which is to have courts not intervene in areas of social policy. Thank you very much.
It's always a great pleasure to be here. I guess I'm going to begin with a little anecdote which involves Jeff Miller, and he tried to summarize on one occasion the differences in judicial philosophy between Frank Easterbrook and myself. And so what he did is he penned a mock constitution in which he gave a few small amendments, one to me and one for Frank, which sort of expressed where we stood on this issue. And the one that he gave for me was called the First Amendment to the First Amendment, and it read something like, Congress shall pass no law, period. And then on the one for Frank, what they did is they changed the Due Process Clause, and they said any person may be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Now, I think the statement about both of us is somewhat inaccurate, but in my case, perhaps less so than in Frank's. But I do think by telling that anecdote, it indicates one of the problems that I think this discussion has that we have to get ourselves to deal with. There has been an implicit assumption that both Frank and Neil made that somehow or other the only mistakes that the Supreme Court makes is to take an exaggerated view of its own jurisdiction and to muscle in on all the activities that are done by the legislative advance. Maybe I'm not reading the same set of Supreme Court advance sheets as they are, but I would think that that wildly overstates and oversimplifies the problem. I would say if I had to go down the list, there are at least as many cases in which the Supreme Court has erred by adopting a version of Chevron deference at the Supreme Court level, a rational basis test, which allows palpably unconstitutional decisions to take place without any interference whatsoever by the court. And indeed, if we accepted Judge Easterbrook's account of why it is that Federalist 10 is so powerful, knowing the risk of faction and so forth, what we would do is our first particular point is to think very hard about the question of why it is that every textual issue that we face in the Constitution should be looked at through the lens of judicial restraint. I've never believed in that particular principle. My view about it is that if you follow text, structure, and history, which both of them referred to, large numbers of things that are now routinely declared constitutional by our noble Supreme Court, in fact, should be declared flatly, totally, completely unconstitutional. And in fact, if you start looking at the public outrage with respect to the decisions, number one in the last 10 years is not Hamden. Number one is surely Kelo. And while as many people said this shows how activist judges ruin the Constitution, that was a case, of course, in which they didn't do anything rather than a case in which they did too much. And what happened was that they lost the legitimacy of the general public in this particular issue, precisely because people thought they were making a joke out of a constitutional amendment. And so we heard such things as, Justice Stevens, what do you mean by public use? Answer, private use. You ask the same question to a First Amendment first-year grader. What do you mean by public use? Use by the public. And so the question is, who has the greatest sophistication on constitutional interpretation? Somebody who's a literalist on the one hand, or somebody who essentially adopts a kind of a progressive mentality, which was certainly not that of the founding fathers, which believe that on all matters of preference and choice and so forth, we should deal with the question of constitutional or judicial deference to legislative actions. Now, if that's one of the very serious problems that we face, the second look doctrine is going to be of no help whatsoever and is essentially largely irrelevant. If the court's going to let the legislature do what they want, there's no question about overriding. And what we really have to do is to ask ourselves how we got into this particular mess in the first place, because the other problem to which Judge Easterbrook and the Ocantial referred to are, in fact, dead right. Cases like Kennedy in Louisiana are simply fantasies on the part of the Supreme Court, which has lost all sight of its, shall we say, moorings. And the same sort of rigorous interpretation that we'd want to bring to it should yield, I think, a very different result. So I'm going to tell another story, since that seems to be all I can do at this hour of the day. And that's the story of what happened at the Yale Law School. I think the case was called Robertson against California, or some such thing, which is the first of the cruel and unusual death penalty cases. The judge will tell me if I got the wrong name, but the story is good anyhow. The style of argumentation, anyhow, at the Yale Law School at the time was that the kids in the moot court program were told to argue a case that was already been decided, and then were told and put on the honor system not to read the final decision on doing it. So if one poor kid was given this case to declare the death penalty unconstitutional under the unconstitutional in some set of facts, so he comes back to his advisor, a guy named Jim Bowers, who now teaches at Texas Tech, and he said, here are the nine arguments. And so Bowers looks at him and says, what about the cruel and unusual punishment clause? Guy says, what are you talking about? There's nothing in the authority on that one. And so he says, go back and look at it some more. And he goes back, I've read it again. There's absolutely nothing in here. Cruel and unusual punishment deals with the question about these circumstances of what kinds of punishments are unconstitutional. It doesn't deal with the question of proportionality between punishment and offense. And I looked at the rest of the document, and there are lots of places that refer to capital punishment. What are you talking about? Look at it again, he was told. So he looked at it again. He came out, what are you doing? And then he said, you argue that point, right? And because the whole issue was the reason we got to Kennedy was because we did this original decision where we so mangled what the clause was about in terms of its object. If proportionality is the issue, there's no explanation why it doesn't apply to non-death cases as well, because death is not mentioned in that particular clause. So every sentence should be reviewable on constitutional ground. So it seems to me that we then have to start going to another question, which is how do we do constitutional interpretation anyhow? And here I am extremely old-fashioned and more proud of being antediluvian with each and every passing day. And what do I mean by that? Well, if you listen to what was going on here, what we were told is that the way in which judges now think of themselves is as a kind of a political branch of government making legislative choices of one kind or another, where in a kind of hyper-modern style, there is no textual sort of prohibition that we can't get around if we apply sufficient ingenuity. There's always a quotation mark that we put down a word that we want to denigrate in order to get somewhere else with respect to the doctrine. And in effect, this is the crisis that we start to face, I think, in trying to deal with judicial power. If, in fact, we start to buy into the kind of the realist view of the world, that all matters of interpretation are ultimately matters of policy, because ingenious judges can turn anything into a question of first impression, so that you can, by, shall we say, clever adjustments, make sure that Congress may pass no law abridging freedom of speech, add in a bunch of exceptions so broad that in the end it actually flips itself over, then I think that what we heard said is exactly right. What Neil said is, hey, this is the way in which the world is going to organize itself. Legislatures think about sunset provisions. Now what we want to do is to have judges start to think about sunset provisions and maybe give their opinions the weight of work done in other circuits after 10 years. I think there's an enormous psychological and institutional cost that is taken by adopting or thinking of any one of these horrific proposals. And the reason is what we are now doing is legitimating the very kinds of practices that we ought to condemn on the part of judges, because what we have to do is to apply a test that Ronald Dworkin always flunks, which is you never come up with a decision on a text that disagrees with the substantive views that you have on any particular occasion. And that kind of ingenuity on the part of judicial bodies is simply inappropriate. So what we really need to do in many cases is to start to think about the capacities and the use of ordinary language. And one of the great tragedies, I think, of American legal education over the last 70 or 80 years is that we do is we regard it as infinitely malleable in the hands of all of us who are cleverer than the guys who wrote the original doctrine. And so if we go back to some kind of sophisticated interpretation which takes words more or less as given and then tries to figure out, because the constitutional interpretation was done against the background of the Roman and continental traditions of interpretation, what kinds of exceptions have to be read into the doctrine in order to make it coherent, you'd do a lot better. That, in turn, would ask you to do, well, what's the police power in the United States Constitution? It isn't written there, and it's been dominant in every clause, substructural and individual that we've ever had. How do we put these two things together? Well, at this particular point, the policy stuff doesn't cut it anymore. The central feature to remember about Madison and faction, and number 10, is that he thought that a government was not designed to manifest popular will over individual rights. It was much more a Lockean vision, in which it turned out you thought people had rights that could be organized out of the state of nature. They surrendered some of their rights to the government in order to receive greater security for those which they were able to retain, and that the whole point of having a system in which democratic majorities could snuff out individual rights was completely misguided. You recognize that on things like whether you declare war against this nation or that nation, you're going to have to use political processes because there's no way you could bind some of us unless you bind all of us, but you don't turn everything into a public good. And at that particular time, you therefore get a very strong classical liberal orientation with respect to your basic clauses. Each of them has powerful guarantees, whether it's speech, religion, and property. All of them are subject to health and safety kinds of objections, narrowly and sensibly construed. You could control monopoly and infrastructure. You've got to be a classical liberal. And so here's what's wrong with the basic modern constitutional interpretation that we see. None of these guys have the slightest inclination to go in that particular direction. So they read the Commerce Clause in unrecognizable fashions. They look at things like the electoral restraints. And after you read a case like McConnell, and you see that, oh, the progressive Elihu Root told you something, you knew that the rest of the opinion was sure to be wrong, and it was. So that you have to face both of these problems. Now, suppose you do want to get override, and I'll end on this point. Going to Congress in these various kinds of gimmicks, this is what I would say is my strategies for doing this. Number one is I'm strongly in favor of term limits for the United States Supreme Court. I think we just have to absolutely amend that document. I think that the whole question that we now have these life terms with long expectations and political maneuverings, just terrible. You get Article III personality at the top level, and it's just the wrong way. People get detached because there's so much slavish adulation and fear of Supreme Court justices. We got to get more rotation and circulation into that provision. I think that's the first thing. Secondly, if you want to talk about sort of overriding, you want to relax the amendment process a little bit, but you don't want to go to simple majorities. And you certainly don't want to go to the Canadian system in which you can just opt out en masse. And so what I would say is, if you wanted to do something like that, and I'm not a thing of it, I would say, okay, you got to get two-thirds of both houses in two successive terms or something like that, and you can only do it with respect to a particular decision. You can never do it grandly. I'm not in favor of all these things, but at least I think that they're better than the alternative. As to referendum and initiatives, one of the things that makes me so opposed to them in many cases now is you look at the horrendous debates that took place with respect to Proposition 8 in California. It's a national disgrace on both sides. The amount of sheer lunacy that was argued for and against, the amount of race and religious hatred that was not race hatred, religious hatred and social antagonisms that came up in the way in which these things were put. What happened is this natural discovery in deliberative democracy generated into a kind of a name-calling contest which left everybody the poorer and the less wise. And why is that the case? Because when you put something like the gay marriage issue on the table one way or the other, there is simply no intermediate positions that people can do when you start talking about this symbolic stuff, and you get a deeply divided populace trying to make these decisions. The right way to handle this, of course, is to take marriage out of the public domain entirely on the licensing issue. That's not a proposal that most people are willing to consider seriously today, but I hope in time they will. But at least we ought to recognize that when we hear the statements about the popular democracy that Madison uttered, the referendum really showed that. In fact, I think the Supreme Court was wrong when they said that these things were constitutional back in 1912, because I do think they're inconsistent with the Republican form of government, which, of course, is not a democratic form of government. That's a different speech. I think I've overstayed my limits, as usual, on one of these occasions. And so I will just end with the following simple plea. If you really want to get this thing right, you have to have judges be judges and legislators be legislators, and you have to understand the difference in the roles. And the modern realist tradition has not made legislators look more like judges, but it has made judges look more like legislators, and that has worked, I think, to the diminution of us all. Thank you.
We will now have a round of rejoinders, and we'll start with Judge Easterbrook.
There's not much to rejoin, but I will say just a few words about the possibility Neil Catchall raised about sunsets on judicial decisions. One can imagine that as a proposal only if you also understand that any judge who would say, my decision is precedential for only 5 years, is conceding that he's not acting as a judge, is conceding that he's acting as a legislator. The very fact of such a decision is a confession that there was no law encoded in the Constitution, and therefore the basis of judicial review was missing. I also tend to agree with Richard Epstein that a proposal of this kind would, if adopted, invite judges to move more into the legislative domain. This is related to the question the Supreme Court wrestled with in the 80s and 90s about whether it could declare a decision prospective only, about whether if the justices handed down a decision, they could declare after the sunburst fashion that it would apply only to future cases. And they ultimately decided not, on the ground that to assert a power to apply the decision only in the future, not to this case, but only in future cases, is to assert a lawmaking power. Justice Scalia filed a separate opinion saying, indeed, it becomes much too easy to legislate from the bench if you don't have to apply your decision to the case at hand. And I would think you have the same problem. It becomes much too easy to legislate from the bench if you say, well, this is just for 5 years until Congress really gets into the act. I said I despair of finding a neutral and useful way of having these decisions come to a second look by the people or Congress. I don't despair of having judicial decisions put under pressure by later legislative action. There's certainly been no lack of legislative challenges to decisions such as Roe against Wade or many of the death penalty cases, as there was earlier no lack of challenges to the Lochner line of cases. So I have to confess that I still remain in despair of a useful solution. If you're going to have, I would, like Richard Epstein, I would much prefer term limits for judges to term limits for decisions.
Let me start by responding to that. I don't think that if you adopt a judicial sunset, it necessarily concedes that the jurist is acting as a legislature. There are any number of constitutional decisions that do turn on factual inquiries. So take Kennedy versus Louisiana. There are two prongs to the Eighth Amendment that the Supreme Court was struggling with. One is the prong about whether a national consensus exists that prohibits the use of the death penalty for the crime of child rape, and the other is a proportionality analysis that Richard alluded to a moment ago as to whether the justices in their own preferences think that it violates the Eighth Amendment to have the use of the death penalty. Now, with respect to the national consensus, I do think it plausible that the Supreme Court could say, look, here's how we read the evidence right now. Six states have it. The federal government has it within the military. We don't think that is enough to create a national consensus for the punishment punishment, and indeed we think it may militate against that the consensus is against the use of the death penalty for this crime. But we're not sure about that over the long term, and so we'd like our decision on this point to only be good for 5 years. I don't think that necessarily concedes the entire store of the game, that still looks like a judicial decision. Or take the War on Terror cases, a case like Hamdi, maybe even the Boumediene case that was recently decided. I think underlying those decisions is a certain conception on the part of the justices about the nature of the terrorist threat we face, about the nature of how of our ability to monitor people who aren't incarcerated. Technology may change massively and make it easy to monitor people and not force them to be detained in 25 years or whatever. And the nature of the threat may change as well. And so it may be appropriate for a judge to say, look, circumstances will change, and therefore we don't think this decision should be good for all time and all places. Now, I agree with Richard. I mean, I think that this has an enormous psychic cost. I'm not in favor of this by any stretch. But right now I think we're in the worst situation, arguably, which is the court is acting like a legislature, but without the tools that legislatures traditionally have to minimize the impact of their errors, things like judicial sunsets. And if we can't adopt tools like judicial sunsets, then it's a good indication, I think, that courts are really straying from their proper role. I do worry about the ex-ante effect of a judicial sunset provision, that a judicial sunset idea, that is, that it kind of embolden judges to act more like legislatures, and I take it that to be Richard's point about the psychic cost. So I only offer this as our kind of last stand. If we've lost the battle, at least let's minimize the impact of losing that battle.
I'm going to say relatively little because I think everything I said was left unchallenged. I'm happy to say, but maybe I'm wrong. And maybe I'll just stop there because why not quit when you're ahead? Thank you.
If the problem is controlling, keeping judges from making public policy, I think the only realistic answer is to end judicial review. As long as human beings have the power to overturn things, that their personal views are going to affect it. I think getting rid of judicial review is actually a much better idea than we think. But it really, in a sense, judicial review is not the problem. The problem is the courts are not disallowing laws that the Constitution prohibits, because the Constitution happily and wisely, in my view, the very opposite of Professor Epstein's view, prohibits very little. Professor Epstein wants no law, and therefore any law that unfortunately occurs is unconstitutional.
You take a joke too seriously, Lena.
Yeah. Richard, it's true, I exaggerate that slightly, but so are you.
Slightly? I exaggerate about Frank, about you. You're your own caricature.
I think both Professor Cattell and Frank essentially came out for what should be Thayer's clear mistake rule. Everybody comes down to, well, they should hold it unconstitutional, but only when it really is. Otherwise, it's a policy judgment. You know, the truth is that they're all policy judgments, virtually all. Judge Posner has written that over and over in his latest book, How Judges Think. That's clearly the case. A clear mistake rule, which they come down to recommending, is fine. And the result of that would be almost nothing is held unconstitutional, nothing that happens, because Congress can read the Constitution. And indeed, the main objection to originalism, having the Constitution mean what it was meant to mean, by Brennan and others, it would leave the court with very little to do. So if you could somehow insist on that, you know, on the question of impeachment, you hear over and over, you don't want judges to be impeached because you disagree with their opinions, which is hard to counter or disagree with. But, you know, how about, can judges be impeached when they tell lies? Can judges be impeached if you can say, this opinion is made up? Throughout this opinion, say, Griggs v. Duke Power or Swan or Weber, you say, when the court says that this is what Congress meant, or there's lots of constitutional history for this, citing nothing, and the constitutional history is absolutely the opposite. So there's no way the judge can think that. These judges are lying. Is that grounds for impeachment?
Which of our panel members want to answer that
I'll
question?
I'll answer that question. Only if you can find a judge who's capable of sitting in the case who has not committed a similar sin somewhere along the line. No, I don't think it's grounds. But you know, I think that the single greatest mistake we make in constitutional interpretation is to assume some global institutional imperative about restraint or intervention. Restraint with respect to democratic processes, intervention with respect to the protection of individual liberties, both of which come out of different halves of the Lockean tradition. Those are both fatal errors. There is no presumption that makes life easy for you. If you've got broad constitutional clauses, you have to read them broadly. No, don't stand up. It's somebody else's term afterwards. And if they're narrow terms, I think you ought to read them narrowly. So taking a test of ordinary meaning doesn't yield Thayer and it doesn't yield Brennan. I like to think it yields at least one of the three members who are sitting on this panel. I will not mention which.
Larry, may I say one thing about this?
Yes, I'm sorry.
I think it would be a very big mistake to abandon judicial review. The whole point is to protect the individual, whether it's a small property owner who has their property being taken away, a kilo-like situation, or an individual accused of terrorism without cause and thrown into a prison and thrown into a system without constitutional warrant, or a corporation that is facing billions of dollars in punitive damages, whatever. I do think that there's a role for the judiciary here. And there are other tools, of course, short of abandoning judicial review altogether that we should think about. One is jurisdiction stripping, so we might want to target individual areas in which the court is particularly prone. We could use confirmation hearings, of course, more effectively instead of. Well, then.
Yes.
I do think we should think about using hearings more effectively. I think the current system of hearings is a disgrace, and it's about, you know, who paid what taxes to whose nanny or whatever, as opposed to being a serious engagement on what an individual juror's constitutional values will look like over time.
I was happy that Lino asked that question. He asked that question of many panels, but he's never asked it of one I've been on. So I've had an answer prepared for about 10 years and never had an opportunity to give it before. You may remember that Oliver Wendell Holmes once said the union wouldn't end if there were no judicial review of
federal decisions.
It would end if there were no judicial review of state decisions. I don't think one could abolish judicial review of what states are doing without effectively repealing the Supremacy Clause. Then you'd have a very fundamental change in the nature of the republic. As for Congress, although Lino often says there are no real constitutional rules, there actually are real constitutional rules that Congress strains against and gets around. I invite you to think about the One House veto decisions in which Congress reorganized the way in which laws are made from the concurrence of both houses to the disapproval of one house or one committee. And Congress's attempts to replace the president's appointing powers with people appointed by Congress. That was one of the issues in Buckley against Valeo. If you don't have judicial review of structural decisions, you would expect Congress, using its budget power, because the president can't run anything if there's no budget, to insist that it make the appointments, that bicameralism be changed, and so on. It's easy to imagine no judicial review in a country like England, which has a unicameral legislature and a coordinate legislature and executive. It's very difficult to imagine getting rid of judicial review in a country like the United States, where that would lead to one branch being able to aggrandize itself at the expense of another.
Okay. We have a question over here, and then you'll be next.
Yeah, my question is for both Neil and Frank, and Richard may have a thought as well. I wonder about second look doctrines in a context where the Supreme Court or the federal courts have ruled and either Congress or the president, or in some cases both, have responded using departmentalism in a way that challenges the court ruling. And three examples of that, one might be City of Bernie against Flores, where the Congress had responded to the Supreme Court's interpretation of the Free Exercise Clause, and the Supreme Court was very resistant to the response. Another example might be the Dickerson case, where Congress had responded to Miranda with the statute. Third situation might be the responses of the Partial Birth Abortion Act. And my question is, when Congress and the President have, in essence, disagreed with the prior Supreme Court opinion and have sent an issue back to the court a second time, I think I clearly agree that the court the second time has to decide the issue itself based on its own independent judgment. But I wonder whether the court ought not to consider stare decisis dissolved in those situations. And the reason it might be considered to be dissolved is that Congress and the President are better placed to evaluate whether the benefits of displacing a prior decision exceed the cost, because the cost-benefit analysis with stare decisis of disappointed expectations versus the benefit of a new rule is very much a sort of policy-making analysis. So I guess the question would be, when Congress and the President respond to court decisions, should the court at that point itself take a second look?
My answer is yes. I think that makes perfect sense for the court to take a second look in those cases. I mentioned the Religious Freedom Restoration Act case and Dickerson. I was very disappointed in the court's treatment of those cases. I think, to elaborate on, just to mention something that Michael Stokes Paulson has said, I think that Congress has complete control over stare decisis. I see no reason why Congress can't set the extent of stare decisis. I'm not ready to embrace Gary Lawson's proposal that stare decisis is everywhere and always unconstitutional. But I think Congress can abrogate stare decisis for a particular case or a particular class of cases and direct the Supreme Court to take a fresh look. It's often a good idea.
And I would agree with that. The one thing I would add is that there is even a textual warrant in particular cases for that, such as Bernie, because they are using the Section 5 power of the 14th Amendment, so there's a special role for Congress contemplated in those cases.
I'm very scared by this whole discussion, and let me explain why. I actually went back and read Marbury and Madison and Martin Hunter's lessee, and I realized that both of them textually are on very shaky footing indeed. To put it mildly, I think Justice Story clearly misread Section 25 of the Judiciary Act, and I wish to thank him for it posthumously. I think that Marbury and Madison has been construed more broadly than it was written, and I would like to thank the judges for that as well. And I think, in effect, that the two central pillars of our system of judicial review are much more extensive than the original Constitution had done it. And to give what Frank had said, the original check with respect to the Supremacy Clause was the judges in every state shall respect the Constitution, which depended on the rule of law version of things that I had articulated, which has been out. And so we now need to go back to the centralized solution. I have no desire to go back on either of those two decisions and think long use has had them. What Steve's question raises, in effect, is do we open wounds of this sort and now start to say, hey, do we really believe in Marbury and Madison and Martin Hunter's lessee after all, given 200 years of acquiescence? And I would like to say the answer is it's kind of prescription is what I call it. 200 years of this stuff, I would never do it myself, but I don't want to undo it when it's done and it works. And I think, in fact, Bernie was right insofar as it said, look, Congress may enforce this by appropriate legislation, but it cannot determine the ends that it can enforce. It can only determine the means to achieve the particular ends in question. And if you go the other way on this, then, in effect, the 14th Amendment, Article 5, is the end of Marbury and Madison. Presidential signing statements are the end of Marbury and Madison. And we will start to get this sort of decentralized government. And the founders may have thought it was fine, but I think the history and test of time has said that our alternative structures are better. And so every time somebody starts talking, as Neil does, about, well, let's use the exceptions clause. Exceptions clause is flatly inconsistent with the notion of judicial review when read literally. If you want to keep judicial review, the only way to do it politically is for everybody to agree not to go there. Because once you go there, you take a scab, which is not healed, You open it up and you will have the most horrendous situation. This is a Humean argument for settled expectation, not an originalist argument for textual fidelity. And it's always hard to figure out which of those two you want, but in this case, I think it's a no-brainer.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. I think this is a question primarily about Neil Katyal's proposal. If I understand the proposal correctly, this is a constraint that the judges would impose upon themselves. They would say, my decision is binding only for 10 years, 5 years, whatever, and presumably also it would only apply in cases where they're intervening in quote-unquote social policy. So if the very person or if the very body whom this doctrine is supposed to constrain is the body that will decide whether it applies or not, and presumably they will also get to decide whether this is a case involving social policy or not, then it's not clear to me that it will actually work as a constraint, given that the decision whether to apply the constraint or not is going to be made by the people who are supposed to be constrained. And moreover, as I think one of your fellow panelists pointed out, maybe Frank Easterbrook, the judge would not only have to constrain himself would it make that decision, but he would have to admit that, you know, impose a sort of pejorative term upon himself and say, oh, yes, I am only making social policy. You know, I admit that. So it seems to me as a practical matter, it's unlikely that judges would tie their own hands this way, as indicated by the fact that they actually have this ability already. The Supreme Court could say that this decision applies for only 10 years, but with very, very rare exceptions, they almost never do that. Maybe Justice O'Connor's statement in Grutter is an exception, but the other justices in the majority didn't seem to agree with her on that, even in that instance. So I was wondering, maybe I just misunderstand the proposal, but I was wondering how it's really going to constrain people if, in fact, the very people who are supposed to be constrained are the ones that get to decide whether it applies or not.
Okay. So I certainly don't think that another branch of government, the president or the Congress, can impose judicial sunsets on the courts. I think that would be fundamentally inconsistent with the separation of powers. But I do think it's possible to envision courts doing it to themselves. After all, the legislatures do it to themselves with respect to sunset clauses. So I think it's possible. And I don't think that it always, I do agree with Richard and Frank's point that in general that there is a massive psychic cost, but I don't think it always is psychic cost. As I said, sometimes the courts are making factual predictions, or they're basing their decision on a certain set of facts. In Boumediene, Justice Kennedy is saying, for example, that we can have habeas corpus proceedings for the Guantanamo detainees without threatening national security. And Justice Scalia, by contrast, is saying more Americans will be killed if you go down this route. These are factual arguments. They're legislative policy decisions being made. So they're already admitting that they're in that realm. In Kennedy versus Louisiana, they're already admitting they're in the realm of counting how many states and what national attitudes are towards the use of the death penalty for child rape. So I don't think that it's as much of a stretch. And let me just say one thing about what Richard said about Steve's question. I take it Steve's question is the Michael Stokes Paulson one, which is, can we allow the legislature to remove the stare decisis effect of a judicial decision? Not can we remove judicial supremacy necessarily. So I don't think it's inconsistent with Marbury to adopt the view that stare decisis can be stripped from a decision. It's still ultimately up to the Supreme Court to follow its previous decision, but it removes some of the binding force. And I do think that is one helpful tool, among others, to try and remove the long-term lock-in effect of an erroneous Supreme Court decision.
I'm scared of it. Let me just state my position now. I don't think we're in a very good place, as Frank has said. But I think every proposal, the moment you start to unleash this thing, you're not going to end up where you want or anyone else ends up. And I don't want to go down a road, because by the time it is done, then what will happen is the Congress will have the power to indicate how you're going to grant certiorari, the presumptions that have to be brought for such case, a whole variety of other encroachments on the judicial branch. I would rather have candid discussions about the imperfection and self-reflection than any effort to try and intrude this with legislative policies, because my view is no one of us is smart enough to figure out what the next move is going to be, and all I can see coming out of an effort to manipulate the current status quo is a downward spiral. So I think at this point your sort of Humean instincts on conservatism are much more powerful institutionally than any of these clever schemes.
and they're just not worth the mess of porridge to try to make a marginal improvement and open yourself up to a massive form of destructive implications for the integrity of the entire system. So please don't go there.
Yes, sir.
I'm actually surprised that we didn't get to the question of second look internal to the Article 3 process, and I'm thinking in particular of Plessy, for instance. I mean, it does seem to me that we do have a second look process built in, and I think of the decision that Richard Epstein referred to, Kelo, and at the same time, in the kind of supremacy sense rather than directly federal Article 3, we have state courts, I believe the case is Hitchcock, they'll correct me if I'm wrong, and others, you know, deciding it differently at a state level, which, you know, whether Kelo eventually became a Plessy and whether it was semantically presented as, you know, more as applied rather than a kind of categorical overruling, don't we really have second look built in?
Yes, but and I think with Brown v. Board it actually worked. It's really complicated. The whole difficulties in this particular area start with the misreading of the Slaughterhouse case back in 1871. It throws privileges and immunities off, therefore too much pressure is put on due process and equal protection and so forth. I do think that correction is appropriate, and the question you want to ask here is, do we believe in a resurrection of the Privileges and Immunities Clause, which characteristically weakens the case for Brown? It doesn't actually strengthen it if you go back to that history. I think the answer is you do, and it's on an ad hoc basis, and my guess is that's the way you want to leave it, because the moment in this particular case you try to get rules that bind judges, you just get two disputes instead of one, and I don't see any clarity coming out of it. I mean, look, I'm as willing to overrule Wickard and Philbin, so don't treat me as being some kind of a wimp, but Mr. Lino Graglia has his jaw wide open, but that's okay. But I would rather do it in the old ramshackle process way, because I think what happens is if you try to make it institutional, you're going to flip thousands of things over at once, and you have no idea of how to control that process. And given where we sit with the level of division and the number of eager beavers we have to make the world a better place, sometimes a little quiescence, at least at this institutional level, is probably a good thing.
Plessy was, of course, around for a very long time before it finally bit the dust. I hadn't considered that process as a form of second look because the topic of the panel is second look by the people or the legislature. For decisions like Plessy, Congress could have used its power under the Commerce Clause. Plessy was about railroads, you remember. Congress could have used its power under the Commerce Clause to supersede Plessy immediately and didn't for legislative reasons. All I can say is I'm extremely happy that we did not have confirmation hearings during the 40s, 50s, and 60s in which senators referred to Plessy as a super precedent that could never be reexamined.
One of the most intelligent things that Frank ever said was he said that you ought to run confirmation hearings and not allow the nominee to testify. I'm beginning to think he's just dead right on that. And that's the reform I would want, Neil. And I'm just curious, Frank, you still stand by that, I hope?
Yes.
Thank you. You got an ally. You got a friend.
I've been puzzled by something for a while, and it's come up here. What is the argument, Professor Kayal mentioned this, for the court using national consensus? And if they are going to use that, even if you don't have congressional action in other areas, it almost seems like there might be a special argument in that one area. I'm not sure how you'd structure it legally. But presumably, the court wouldn't be the obvious place to judge what the national consensus of the country is. So I'm just curious. I never understood the argument.
Well, Kennedy?
Well, the textual...
In Kennedy specifically.
The textual clause we're referring to is, of course, the Eighth Amendment's prohibition against cruel and unusual punishment. And so I take it that the court has said for at least 40 years, if not longer, that in interpreting the word unusual, they are to look to the attitudes of the nation. Now, I think your question is, well, why is the court better at it than some other body, you know, even, say, Gallup, let alone, you know, and that's a deep question. And I guess the argument in favor of the judicial resolution of it is, well, they'll get the briefs on both sides, they can cite polls and all the arrests, and then they make a decision. But it isn't a very satisfying one, particularly because of, as I say, this lock-in effect, that if they get it wrong, it's really hard to ever change that result.
The unusual stuff makes sense if you read it as part of the original document in which the death penalty was secured by virtue of the double jeopardy clause and the due process clause, and unusual only meant to the types of punishment in question. But the moment you start saying unusual for a particular offense, then every time somebody repeals a state statute which talks about death for child rape, it changes the constitutionality of it. That strikes me as being completely bonkers. That is, using the consensus approach with the broad interpretation of cruel and unusual punishment creates the toxic brew that we get in that case. Give it the narrower interpretation and it turns out that the consensus is appropriate. And as Frank said, and he was just dead right about this, the whole purpose of a federalist system is laboratories of experimentation. And if 49 states want to go one way and the 50th wants to go the other, the vote doesn't count under these circumstances. And on that, too, remember, originally it's pretty clear that the Eighth Amendment did not apply to the states. I think that's right. And it's only either the due process clause or the fevered imagination of judges that got it there.
It's necessary to understand the history of this. The Supreme Court just totally misunderstood the cruel and unusual punishments clause in the case that Gene is referring to, which I think is Tropp against Dulles in the mid-60s, in saying that unusual meant not used in enough states or enough places. The original meaning of unusual was made up by judges rather than by legislators. That's language taken over from the Bill of Rights in the wake of the Glorious Revolution of 1689, and that was the meaning. It was a response to what Lord Chief Justice Jeffreys had been doing in making up punishments that had never been approved by Parliament. So unusual was a restriction on what judges could do. It wasn't a restriction on what legislators could do, and it's been taken over by the court as an empowerment of judges and a restriction of legislators. That's the Constitution on its head.
With respect to the notion of judicial sunset, that is, that the judges should or could impose their own time limits on their decisions, I think we do have experience of that back in 1982 with the Northern Pipeline case. The bankruptcy case in which the court held the entire bankruptcy system unconstitutional, but in the opinion created a stay of its decision that the bankruptcy system was unconstitutional because the Article I judges, according to the court, were given too many Article III powers. That was the reasoning of the Berger court. In that case, the court stayed its opinion, I believe, for 5 months to give the Congress time to enact remedial legislation correcting the constitutional defect. And in that situation, the situation rapidly spun into a constitutional disaster because Congress failed to act, and the deadline the court had set, the stay, expired. So if one followed the court's reasoning, the bankruptcy system then had been declared unconstitutional and there was no stay, and Congress had failed to act. So the outcome was that the Judicial Conference of the United States enacted a so-called emergency regulation permitting the bankruptcy system to continue to operate without congressional authorization in the face of a Supreme Court decision declaring the system unconstitutional. Congress failed to act for three or four years. They finally enacted something, I think, 4 years later. But during that entire time, in the mid-1980s, we had a bankruptcy system operating essentially under an administrative order of the Judicial Conference of the United States. The point being that isn't it a bit naive to assume that Congress is going to jump into the breach if the court self-imposes sunsets its own decisions? Isn't that really, really naive given that set of circumstances?
Well, it obviously depends on the particular thing they're using it for. I certainly don't think that if they used it in Kennedy versus Louisiana that you would have seen a inattention on the part of state and federal legislatures to jump into the breach. But I agree with the basic point you're saying, which is, look, it's a very dangerous thing, and we shouldn't really tolerate a system in which the court is commandeering the Congress to act in a particular way, just as we shouldn't tolerate something which the Congress is commandeering the court to act. I don't think that's the way the sunset would work in practice. It would rather be to try to just remove the massive super precedent stare decisis effect of a holding, not to force the legislature to act in any particular way.
I have a better idea. It just occurred to me. First of all, I'm sufficiently naive. I don't understand why there are Article I courts at all. But, I mean, the judicial power is in Article III. So this is what I would have done in this case. I would have said, you guys want to create things. It's complete chaos to say that these things are null and void. So we have one of two choices when you're going to act unlawfully. One is we could say they're no courts, or two, we could make them Article III courts, and then they're Article III courts. They have full powers, and you can't remove them for life. That's what I would have written based upon the last 15 seconds worth of solemn reflection. Is there anything... And it seems to me to be the right answer, actually. I mean, because I just don't understand. I mean, you know, we talked about lawless behavior. Am I missing something? Is there a case somewhere for Article I courts? Like there's a case for independent administrative agencies, which I also think is unconstitutional. I mean, is there, you know, like if this is sort of reminds me of the Potter, Harry Potter stories, you know, that you go into Gate 7A between the other two. They're not written there, but you can see them. I really don't understand. Am I wrong?
Somebody well, Richard, can't. Certainly courts martial. I mean, I would think that, I mean, that military courts would be a good example in which we don't.
There is authorization for that in order, isn't it?
Yeah, but they're not Article III.
Yeah, but I mean, but I think if you look in Article I, you could find reasons in the power to set up the military system.
Yes, sir. My question is for Professor Epstein. You seem to have articulated an interpretation in the Constitution that would invalidate many more laws than the current Supreme Court does, and I tend to agree with you. I would agree with Congress should make no law off amendment also.
I don't agree with that amendment.
Well, I agree with that, so we're in disagreement there. But you served, you've been a professor at the University of Chicago for a long time, and Senator Obama was also a professor there. Do you have any sense of whether he has read or has knowledge of your large literature on this subject and whether he understands it? I know he disagrees with it, but...
God, I'd like to take the Fifth Amendment on that one. let's put it to you this way. He's been better at politics than he was as an academic scholar, but he was a great teacher. Let's just leave it at that. No, I think, in effect, I mean, I said this in the New York Times, I think he basically did not try to engage consciously and intellectually, given that he was not a full-time member of the faculty, people whose views might have been somewhat different from his own. I would hope he would do so now, because I think it's extremely important that any president get the strongest possible arguments from the people on the other side before he goes forward on anything that he does, and I think so far he's handled the transition in a remarkably professional way, and let's just hope that he continues to do so, notwithstanding our enormous differences on all sorts of substantive issues, which I don't think this panel is dedicated to resolving.
I find it interesting that after nearly an hour and 45 minutes of discussion, there's been almost no discussion of the second look opportunity that the founders gave us, which is the amendment process. And sort of inherent in that is it must be just a premise that amendment process has become unworkable for, I'm sure, political reasons, because there's nothing textually that makes it unworkable. And I just kind of ask folks, is there a realistic prospect that a couple of amendments on a couple of specific topics might change judicial behavior in the sense that simply some kind of an amendment that tells the court to apply the Constitution as written and not to make up laws that aren't there and to apply the limits that are there, just a couple of examples of that, might over time change behavior? And if the answer to that is we can't get it done, what does that say about the existence of a national consensus to hold the court to the Constitution?
Oh, you're not going to get anything done at that level. I mean, the last serious effort with respect to this, I guess, was the Equal Rights Amendment with respect to sex discrimination. It was kind of instructive to look at the rate. The first 20-odd states went through this thing just right away, and then as you got closer and closer to the finish line, it got slower and slower because somebody says, now what does this mean? And then you started to try and figure out how it's going to apply to 10,000 social institutions, all of which have some sex discrimination built into it. And the basic intuition I think that most people had is you could easily see how to run a nation in which formal distinctions based on race don't matter in the public life. Very hard to figure out how you're going to do that with respect to sex. And so if you're going to have to pick and choose between them, it's a judicial nightmare, and then people back off. And I think the lesson that we've learned from that, or haven't, is that sort of broad-based constitutional guarantees with implied exceptions to that have caused us enough difficulty. And if you try and move in a different direction without any background history or organization, you're just asking for trouble. So even people who have strong commitments to sexual equality basically prefer to work in limited fashion through the Equal Protection Clause and don't have to do that anymore because they're the ones in control of the legislature at this particular point, so that they have much less need for this kind of thing happening. And again, I'm just worried about a runaway process starting over and making things worse than it already is.
Yeah. Judge, you have any? Well, we are out of time. Let's just give our panel a round of applause for a wonderful discussion.